warmly welcome Brownlee Perry today, who has made the way from the Department of Social Science, Health and Medicine at the King's College in London, right here in Frankfurt. And as you perhaps know, she's working on how human-environment relations are being recast by technological and economic change. And she's working on issues as interesting as life science industry, the commodification of life forms, post-humanism, applied body ethics, or the regulation of nature. And I think this is perfect for our lecture series here. And but also further, not only that, I think what is very interesting about her is that she did a very interesting interactive exhibition called Mind Over Matter with an artist in 2011. And there she explored a little bit the attitude of memory loss and brain donation for dementia research with, and I think this is very interesting, with the means of visual communication and arts. I think this is, I wanted to mention that. Further, she works for the National Council on Bioethics and as a consultant for the UN and the UK government. And what we will hear from her today is a little bit controversial. And I think if there are some things that might appear controversial to you, then you have to blame Peter for that, because he opted not to have an educational talk of her, but rather some insights in her latest thought and ongoing research. And I think we are looking very much forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Iris, and thank you all very much for having me in Frankfurt. Now, I feel a bit sad that you've got this beautiful technological devices here, and I have elected not to use it. So for once, I am not going to use a PowerPoint. I'm just going to talk to you. And I hope that one advantage of that is that I will talk slowly and that you will be able to understand what I'm going to talk about. Now, when we began, Iris was right in saying that I spoke to Peter on email and said, I've got two talks. One is the educational one on bodily commodification, and the other one is the one that's on my latest work, which is about assisted reproduction, and it's about the rollout of fertility services to developing countries, in particular to India, but in other parts of the world as well. And I said, but it's a bit controversial. And I said, which of these would you like to have? And he said, I'll definitely have the controversial one, thank you. So if it's not educational in the normal sense of things, then you can blame him. Okay, so those of you who know about my work, I'm just going to speak a little bit about this first to sort of frame what I next do. Will know that I've written a lot about the commodification of the body and how that's been driven by two technological and economic developments. The first of those is the molecular revolution, which has enabled the human body to be disaggregated into finer and finer parts, to create an intimate kind of mining of the body, and to allow us to create. Paul Rabinow has this quote, who says, to enable to make the body a discrete, knowable, and exploitable reservoir of molecular and biochemical products and events. And the second thing is that those biotechnologies have enabled us to do some interesting things in terms of creating what I have called elsewhere new kind of artifactual renderings of the body. So what I mean by that is to stabilize these bits of the body in unusual ways. So to make things like cell lines, for example, or tissue arrays, or bioinformation, renderings of the bodies, kind of manufactures of the body. And the reason why they're interesting is because they're so stripped down. It's sort of like an assemblage that has had most of it removed, so that what you're left with is something that becomes what I've called hypermobile. So it can be circulated around the world with dizzying speed, up and downloaded from different places with great ease. And the third thing, the economic development that's made a big difference, has been, of course, the rise of late capitalism, expansionary forces of late capitalism, particularly neoliberalism, which have legitimated the extension of property rights, private property rights, and the commodity fetish, we might call it, to all manner of previously freely available goods and services, including human body parts, but also forms of bodily labour. Now, I was going to speak about the former, the commodification of the body parts, but I'm not. Right? Today I'm going to talk about the latter. I'm going to talk about this bodily labour. And what I want to think about in the bioeconomy, okay, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a sort of pose a challenge, really, to the way academics in particular, and shortly, or now, but in the future, I hope, that will be all of you as well, the way we think about and represent these forms of bodily labour. Now, so what I'm going to do is, I don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to restrict myself to discussing this in terms of the work that I'm undertaking at the moment on the assisted reproduction industry. So in the course of that research, I've been reading very widely lots of accounts about assisted reproduction and the kinds of labour that are involved in that field. And I've become aware of a number of presumptions that I think underpin the ways in which we think about, talk about, write about, and generally represent this assisted technology industry. And presumptions that I think often go unnoticed, they often go undebated, even though I think they have quite profound political effects. So one of those sets of presumptions that I have noticed emerging in recent times relates to the kinds of labour that are purportedly, supposedly, involved in assisted reproduction and the ways that labour is represented and analysed. Now, this is maybe the controversial bit. I think a lot of these accounts, as I hope to show today, follow some now rather well-worn narrative pathways. It's a very familiar story to us now about the nature and progression of neoliberalism and its protagonists. So who is involved in this neoliberal endeavour? And I think a lot of these accounts have actually been generated at quite some epistemological and geographical distance. So in other words, from people who are not directly involved in this area and even at some geographic distance. And they're being called upon to perform the work of kind of substantiating an argument about the perils of neoliberalism without, as my father would have said, letting the detail of context, in this case, get in the way of a good story. So there's something quite comfortable and self-assured about these accounts, I think, particularly for an audience of white, Western, middle-class academics. However, when they're unpicked, I find that they prove to be in many ways quite gendered and quite racialised in ways that make me, for one, somewhat uncomfortable. So what I want to do today is take the opportunity that's presented to me here to challenge or at least unsettle some of these accounts in what I hope will be a productive fashion. Okay, so I'm going to try and cram in as much controversial content as I can in the hope of not having a boring discussion period. So I'm going to take two separate hubs for reproductive service provision, California in the United States and Jaipur in India, and two separate kinds of reproductive practices, sperm donation on the one hand and surrogacy on the other hand, to illustrate some of the concerns I have about the way that particular varieties of labour involved in both are discussed and presented both within the academy and in the public domain. Okay, so I'll press on because time is short. Now, I can only outline my argument here, but I hope it will be one that may prove of some interest. And I concentrate here quite a bit on Kathy Walby and Melinda Cooper's work, but there are many others that follow their lead, so it's not meant to be in any way personal or selective. And I had dinner with Kathy in London just recently, so I'm sure she'll forgive me for this. So Kathy, in her soon-to-be-released book that's written with Melinda Cooper, to which I've had advanced access, argues, and you'll probably know this argument if you know anything about this field, that the what they call the in vivo, the in-body biology of human subjects is becoming increasingly central to the organisation of the post-Fordist economy, particularly the life sciences industry. This is an industry, they argue, which increasingly relies, and this is a key point, and this is a quote, on an extensive yet unacknowledged labour force whose services consist in the visceral, gut-like, visceral experience of experimental drug consumption, hormonal transformation, and more or less invasive biomedical procedures, ejaculation, tissue extraction, gestation, and so on. Okay? So it's all about the kind of lived experience of the body. These are forms of work that they go on to characterise as, and I quote, clinical labour. So they're characterising them all as forms of clinical labour. They argue, as many other people have also done, that the emergence of post-Fordist and neoliberal modes of economic organisation and governance have invoked profound shifts in the way labour is organised in the 21st century, that's seen a change, this would be the argument, from a mid-20th century system of statutory labour protections, occupational health and safety and all that, right? And secure conditions of employment to what we have now, they argue, which is a much more precarious form of labour that we have now, which involves outsourcing to private contractors with a concomitant increase in exposure to occupational health and safety risks, financial exploitation, ill health, etc. You must know that story very well, okay? From the safety and security of the mid-20th century post-Fordist regime, secure conditions of work, labour protections, to this precarious world that we now live in where no one has any, you know, labour protection, people are in very precarious forms of employment. So clinical labourers, those individuals who, this is their quote, act as independent contractors of their biological capital, right? So they're contracting out their biological capital, their own bodies, are, they argue, even more tightly enmeshed in these new forms of precarious service labour than almost anyone else. And yet they, more even than their historical counterparts, as they put it, and this is a key point, labour without labour protection. So they're very, very vulnerable, is what they're saying, these clinical labourers. They are, they suggest, obliged to assume both the economic and corporeal risks of the biomedical innovation economy. So they're the ones being experimented on. They're very vulnerable, okay? The key actors in the drama of clinical labour are here characterised, as they are in many other academic papers like this, as the contingent workers of the bioeconomy. To use their examples, they are people who have to engage in high-risk clinical trial work, for instance, who use, or they're uninsured patients who take part in clinical trials in exchange for medication, or they're poor women who are involved in egg vending, or they're people who are donating their organs and tissues to banks for money, etc. Okay, so you've got that picture, I hope, now. So what's emerging very clearly from that narrative is the sense that these clinical labourers are in many respects victims of a voracious neoliberalism. They are being gobbled up by neoliberalism, exploited financially, in precarious employment, working under very oppressive contractual service relationships in the bioeconomy, and particularly in the reproductive services sector. Now, What troubles me slightly about these forms of analysis is the way in which one, many different types of clinical labour are casually conflated and assumed to occupy similar positions within this generalised bioeconomy. And two, how quite overarching and very normative assumptions are made about the kinds of labour these labourers contribute, and very importantly, what their motivations are for contributing that labour. A set of assumptions that, I would argue, are very context insensitive. Now, in order to recalibrate some of that analysis, I want to look at two kinds of reproductive work, shall we say, that falls into this broad category of clinical labour, and pose some searching questions about each. So let's go first of all to California and the world of gamete donation. Now, there is little doubt that in terms of the labour, the requisite labour, there are distinct differences in the kinds of labour contributed here by women and men, that is, donating eggs or donating sperm. Notwithstanding testing regimes and disruptions to work schedules and so on, the labour contributed by women in gamete donation is more intensive, the corporeal demands are more invasive, and so forth. But let's just concentrate for a minute on the labour of sperm donors in America and pose some questions about how this labour could or should be characterised, and why those donors are motivated to perform it. Okay, so the individuals that, there are many different kinds of sperm donors in California, but let's just stick to those that I've been researching lately, who are the individuals recruited to the world's largest exporting sperm bank, California Cryo. Now, it might interest you to know that the international market for US sperm is now in excess of $100 million annually. And that, I was going to say, that's a lot of white goods. I don't know if that joke quite translates, but let's hope it does. And that California Cryo has a 65% share of that export market, so it can only be considered to be occupying a position right at the very heart of this global bioeconomy in reproductive material. Now, the first thing to know about California Cryo's donors is that these donors are not just anyone. That's the first thing to know. California Cryo Bank, for example, proudly boasts that they accept less than 1% of all individuals who apply to become a sperm donor. I mean, you know, just do that in reverse. 99% of people are rejected. Men are rejected. The criteria for inclusion reveal much about why the failure rate is so high. The bank has a formal policy of rejecting any donor who is less than 5'9" tall, or who is not either currently undertaking a 4-year degree course at a university or already has a bachelor or higher educational degree. They also note that their preference is to, quote, actively recruit donors from top US universities, end quote, such as Harvard, Yale, Princeton, etc. Those who do not conform to these criteria are made to appear as outliers, even though, in fact, it is they who make up the largest proportion of the general population. So I'm sure I would probably fail that, and probably most of you would as well. Despite the fact that the individuals that are identified on the basis of this social screening already constitute a tiny proportion of the population, even their selection is by no means assured. So rather, the bank considers these qualities to be simply, and I quote, basic requirements for recruitment, noting that only those who meet them will be moved on to, as they describe, the next step in our qualification process. This involves, as they describe it, and I quote, conforming to our unwavering benchmarks by which potential sperm donations are measured, which includes everything from extensive medical testing to genetic screening. Now, these donors constitute, without any question, a biosocial elite. They are comprised of, as they say in the selective breeding vernacular in agriculture, as high genetic merit individuals. Okay? Now, they do receive some compensation for their labour, but they're not in any way dependent on that income. As you can imagine, these are not people who do not have a job, okay? They're phenomenally well paid. They're an economic elite as well. So these individuals would not construct themselves and indeed could not feasibly be constructed as exploited or oppressed clinical service workers. I would suggest conversely that they perceive themselves to be what I would call benefactors of a kind of philanthropic labour. That means a kind of donating charitably from your wealth of personal resources to those who are less fortunate than yourself. Does that sort of translate? Yeah? One animated by a concern for human welfare and advancement, and manifested by the endowment of capital, in this case their biological capital, to needy persons or institutions for quote unquote socially useful purposes. Now, I would like to pose at this point three questions. How is this kind of philanthropic labour accounted for within these more overarching accounts of clinical or in vivo biological labour? Where is it? Is it anywhere? Not so I can see so far. Whose interests does this kind of philanthropic labour actually serve? And three, and this is important when I come to my second part of the talk, who is allowed to occupy the position of being a benefactor of philanthropic labour, and who, conversely, may not. So to try and begin to answer these questions, I want to juxtapose now, put them next to each other, the experiences of these Californian sperm bankers with some women surrogates in India. So let's begin with question one, which was, how is this kind of philanthropic labour accounted for within these overarching accounts of clinical labour? Well, the answer to that, I think, is not very well. So clinical labourers are almost always characterised as individuals who are drawn into service under duress. So they're pressed into service unwillingly. Individuals who participate in this risky, precarious economy because of extreme financial need. A lot of presumptions are made here about their motivations to participate that I would argue are very generalised and not universally sustained. If we look at these California sperm donors, it becomes clear, for example, that this particular class of clinical labourers are not socially marginalised, far from it. They are not economically disadvantaged. They have not been driven into this form of service work. It carries with it, in fact, very few biological risks and is not terribly demanding. Despite this, their labour is intensely valorised. In many published accounts of sperm banking and in the publicity materials generated by the banks themselves, these individuals are celebrated for their selflessness. Their labour is presented as philanthropic, performed in the service of those who, due to some quirk of fate or biology, find themselves in need of donated gametes. I would argue, however, that more complex and arguably less benign, less kindly, compulsions may also act as motivating factors for this class of labourers. And this brings us on to question two, whose interests does this kind of philanthropic labour actually serve? Now, their labour is most usually represented as a form of gifting of which the recipient is the primary beneficiary. But to understand the dynamics of this economy, we must first understand something more about what is actually commodified here what its value is and to whom. What is being captured through the commodification of their reproductive labour, these elite sperm bankers, I would argue, is something more akin to pedigree. Does that, what's the word for that in German? Can anyone tell me? Pedigree. You know, when you have a, when you're breeding animals and you have a chart that tells you which is the best one?
Stumble.
Thank you. I'll take your word for it. That's pedigree. So I would argue that what is being commodified here is something more akin to pedigree, their pedigree, or even their class, than it is bodily labour power or corporeal material per se. Make no mistake, the dynamics that animate contemporary human sperm banking in California today, I would argue, are precisely the same that have animated practices of selective breeding in animal husbandry and agriculture for generations. In both cases, formal pedigrees and metrical technologies for assessing the worth of the stock, such as genetic marker tests, are employed to separate desirable from undesirable animals, creating new sets of truth claims about the worth of particular individuals and, moreover, of how that worth might be captured and transmitted both biologically and intergenerationally. This project is about fulfilling a, frankly, rather eugenicist agenda of propagating the fit, the best, where the fit is the selfless sperm donor. But what then is so philanthropic about that labour, I ask you? It's interesting, I think, that the work that their clinical labour performs in this context is basically to provide a means through which to clone the donor. So it's a kind of way of perpetuating the elite more than arguably anything else. As Sarah Franklin notes, the figure of the clone is deeply troubling to many in advanced Western economies. Clones evoke complex anxieties about the loss of individual uniqueness, or as she puts it, the fear of being made to order or copied is one of loss, devaluation, or worthlessness, of being derivative, barren, or unoriginal. This horror of duplication and the taint of fraud has, and this is a quote, stigmatized the figure of the double, the replicant, or the multiple, resulting in capitalist economies in the prohibition of cloned products, which are seen as illegitimate in the same way that bastard offspring are when they are shamed by a lack of proper parentage. However, the polarity of these dynamics is here dramatically reversed. Donors, I would argue, are effectively being invited to sort of clone themselves, not literally, but you know what I mean, perpetuate themselves, in a broad sense, by ensuring that their highly valorised genetic material is stored, archived for future use, perpetuated down the line. However, their labour is not considered abject, but is highly valued, precisely because the propriety and the quality of the individual that their labour seemingly replicates, themselves that is already known and assured. This is first-rate, top-drawer material that's being replicated here. Okay, so in short, this is a kind of vanity project, we might say, on their part. So the donor's biological capital becomes a key source of economic productivity, that's for sure, but it is realised primarily, I would argue, by virtue of their philanthropic rather than their clinical labour per se. So what makes their labour clinical, we might ask then finally, apart from perhaps performing the act of donation in a clinic? So if we just take that out of the picture, then in what way would we really think of that as clinical labour? Now, other forms of reproductive labour are characterised in rather different ways. So let's now turn to Jaipur in India and to the practice of surrogacy. Surrogacy in India is generally portrayed in public and academic accounts as a demeaning form of labour. The women involved are cast as archetypical clinical labourers. So when Kathy and Melinda talk about clinical labour, this is the person they've got in their mind. Evidence is produced to sustain that argument. They are routinely characterised as exploited service providers who are exposed to very significant biological and psychological risks without adequate protection in circumstances where the rate of remuneration, the amount they're paid, fails to adequately compensate for the labour required. Now, time precludes a very detailed discussion of the variances of women's experience as surrogates in India, but I have been struck by some of the countervailing views, that's opposite views, on surrogacy that are emerging from our research in India, which is currently underway. Many comments on the labour relations at work in surrogacy, offered by those who are directly involved in the industry, provide some perspectives that challenge this narrative of surrogates as exploited and marginalised clinical labour as the fodder of a rampant neoliberal bioeconomy. This quote, for example, comes from a highly educated specialist hospital consultant, an Indian who is part of the transnational elite, with a high-level consultancy at a top London hospital as well as with a top hospital in Jaipur, okay? Who's worked for many years in India and who has personally been involved in setting up ART clinics in Jaipur that service many, including women from the metropolitan west, that be us, as well as India's rural poor. And this is a quote. There are many women who say that surrogates are selling the womb or renting the womb and that they are exploiting these women, but they're concentrating on the wrong thing. The emphasis has never been on the quality of ART services, and it should have been. I wish they could spend their energy on rationalising IVF services and getting quality control over these clinics. And what they mean there are those clinics that just pop up all over India, staffed by people who have no qualifications and who do exactly whatever they like. Instead of fighting year after year and debating on whether surrogacy is right or wrong, on whether egg donation is right or wrong, they're wasting their time. It's personal choice. I mean, how many rickshaw pullers, because I used to sit in rickshaws, and I asked them if they experienced much pain or anything, and many of them have severe knee problems or back problems. So they are selling their bodies on a daily basis for like 5 rupees, 10 rupees every day. You can give an emotional twist to surrogacy, but they're paid a very good amount of money and cared for very well for the work they do. I never compare this with prostitution. People do, but there really is no kind of... There is really no equal. That is a different kind of exploitation, and this is an interesting point. They, prostitutes, don't have a choice, and these women have a choice, and they do it because they are helping another woman too. Now, that quote raised for me some very important questions about how we characterise these women's clinical labour, the surrogates, and of how such readings can or ought to be shaped by considerations of context. Now, Kathy Welby and others suggest that clinical labour is one in which the corporeality, the bodily fabric of the individual, is the resource that is exploited and capitalised on. Welby suggests, for example, that, and this is a quote, women's reproductive biology has become the focus of extensive biomedical research interest and global commercial innovation. This constitutes another form, this is a quote from her, of neoliberalised life, this time situated at the level of biological processes and part of a much larger marketisation of biological vitality. End quote. In making this argument, they suggest that surrogacy,
egg vending, transactional sex are instances where women provide contractual use of their bodily capacities to others. Now, I haven't yet quite established, though, in my mind, how these forms of clinical labour in the contemporary bioeconomy differ from earlier historical modes of contractual bodily exploitation. At all stages of human development and in all economic systems, from the feudal to the agrarian, from the industrial to the post-industrial, the unique corporealities of particular individuals, whether that's the hulking strength of the stonemason to the lush endowments of the Victorian wet nurse, the vitality of each, along with the rickshaw pullers, has been exploited until exhaustion, often under precarious forms of contract labour. In this sense, many forms of bodily exploitation occur every day in India. As argued by my interlocutor, when suitably regulated in licensed clinics, surrogacy can be amongst the least demanding of these. However, it is very rarely presented as a sensible occupation. I recognise that regulation is not always the norm, and I, like many other feminists, have harboured serious concerns about surrogacy. My interviewee would argue, though, that it is not the clinical labour of surrogacy itself that is necessarily exploitative, although I accept that some would refute that, but rather, they would argue, the conditions in which it is sometimes, but it must be said not routinely, practised. So the laissez-faire approach to regulation that seems to typify neoliberal modes of economic organisation generates forms of exploitation, to be sure, but these are not, our Indian clinicians would argue, always or only evidenced in relationship to clinical labour practices. So Walby argues that sex workers successfully lobbied, in some countries at least, for regulation of sex work as a form of labour, that they secured rights not only to sufficient wages but also to medical care, occupational health and safety, natural justice, work security, and rights to set limits on the demands made by clients. And she argues that aligning surrogacy as a commensurate form of labour will provide the leverage to sustain similar regularisation of those clinical labour practices. Ironically, though, what I discovered in my time recently in India is that in many ART-assisted reproduction clinics in India, those rights have already been secured. And these women have exercised their autonomy, their agency, in making considered and informed judgments that their conditions of work, remuneration and care will be much better in the surrogacy clinic workplace than they would be working in any of the other desperately menial, exploitative, agricultural or industrial jobs that are their only other forms of employment. And I recently discovered that a 9-month surrogacy will earn a woman in India the equivalent of 15 years of work in their other, you know, in the other, as it were, jobs they could get. So just bear that in mind. So where does that leave us then, finally, in accounts of the pernicious and exploitative practices of neoliberalism? Now, one interviewee, the one that I quoted from earlier, would argue that the worst excesses of neoliberalism are evidenced not in the way that the conditions that these women labour under, the surrogates, but rather evidenced in the gross forms of malpractice that are visited on clients of fertility services in these pop-up clinics, as I call them, staffed by untrained and unlicensed practitioners. So I could go out and set one up tomorrow and, you know, anyone can set anything up anywhere and bring people through the door, charge them money and so on. They would argue that these are the women that are really exploited in this economy, as they are treated at great personal expense with absolutely no possibility at all that they will become pregnant and I know have evidence of people even being injected with water instead of gonadotropins and so forth, as these clinics are staffed by quacks and charlatans, and unlike surrogates, those women will be driven into penury as a consequence of the complete absence of appropriate regulation. That, they argue, is the cause for real concern both politically and ethically. But what, lastly, of the other kinds of labour that surrogates contribute in this reproductive economy? It seems to me that, as the interviewees suggest, they are motivated to participate, not simply by money. It is not just economic need that drives their involvement. Although obviously it's a factor, that I would suggest is actually far too simplistic and unnuanced a reading. For many surrogates, their work is, in many respects, also a philanthropic labour. As one interviewee noted in discussing Indian women who use Indian surrogates, from the patient's perspective, that's the infertile woman, they will go to any extent. In India, it's like a disease not having a child. You can't just treat it in bodily terms. You need to think in social and mental terms, as all their aspects of life are fulfilled by having a child, their psychological, their mental life, everything. And another IVF specialist who's a woman consultant explained to me, so my husband says, you are destined to help these women, and now I run a clinic and employ 12 people. And some of these are surrogates because that's a service the clinic offers. And these surrogates participate not just to earn money, but also because they want to help to reduce the enormous stigma that attaches to infertility in India and abroad. However, one of the issues that I have with the arguably both racialised and gendered accounts that are offered of surrogacy that characterise the practitioners, that is the surrogates, as an oppressed, exploited minority operating under duress in high-risk conditions is, and this is the key point, that such accounts do not allow, they actually actively prevent such women, the poor Indian peasant, from occupying the role of benefactor of philanthropic labour to the more privileged Indian or white Western women and men who find themselves in need of their services. By keeping them in the role of oppressed and exploited clinical labourer, and by simultaneously denying the significance of their philanthropic labour, a certain wrong is perpetuated against them, in my view. And I think it is incumbent on us, in the final analysis, to give some time and some thought to the question of what work keeping them in this submissive subaltern role performs for those of us who have the privilege of constructing widely read, published accounts of their lived experience on their behalf. Thank you. Anyone want to disagree with that? No, that's true. You're right. That what I was trying to do there really was to sort of
unsettle these now very commonplace accounts that the people who are the beneficiaries of these are the women or the, you know, the clients who come to the clinic and use the material. And what I was trying to do there was to suggest, of course you're right, what's captured, the value that is captured, is what I tried to suggest about, you know, they're capturing their pedigree, if you like. They're capturing their class, and they're economising that, you know, by charging differential amounts of money, by the way, according to where you are up the, you know, hierarchy. But also to suggest that there is a different kind of motivation for that labour there. And the idea of kind of, it's a bit like being in Mensa, you know, the organisation of the top 1% of intelligent people in the world, you know. There is a certain kudos that attaches to being one of that elite that even the benefactor, the donor, can, if you like, trade off in some kind of way. Not in sort of strict economic terms, but certainly in other sort of biosocial terms, there are definite advantages for them to find themselves amongst that elite. And there's also the ability to kind of perpetuate yourself, your genetic stock and so on, down, you know, in evolutionary terms across a very wide pool of recipients, more than you'd probably get round to personally, you know?
But to follow up on that point, does this actually happen? Is this something that these 1% of sperm donors, this status, is this something that they can present or use as a form of, I don't know, social capital maybe? I mean, is this something that you're going to write on your Vita?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I haven't interviewed them to know, but I think, you know, I mean, as I said, California Cryo makes it very clear all across their, you know, their website that they accept less than 1% of all individuals who seek to donate. So if you were, I don't know, but I can imagine if you did find yourself in that, you ask yourself that question, if you did find yourself in that 1%, now answer me honestly. You're in the 1%. And you're thinking, I'm asking you, are you going to never tell anybody that?
Well, I'm...
I might. He says, I might. You know, I might. You know, there might be some particularly attractive person I kind of... I don't think I could resist. Put your hand up if honestly you think you could not ever tell anyone that you got into the top 1%. See anyone. So at least we know these Germans are very honest. So, you know, I mean, you're right. Do you trade on it? You know, I mean, in not strictly technical sense, I wouldn't put it on my CV, but it has some sort of currency, shall we say, I think.
Yeah. But I wonder how, I mean, these people who are going in the top 1%, these are the people who, like you said in your presentation, they don't need the money. They're oftentimes the people who are very busy, don't have the time. Mm-hmm. So of this 1% or less than 1%, how many people actually go? And how do they attract these people to them? I'm saying, hey, you know, even that 1% can.
Well, you know, I think that's such an interesting point. They don't need to go. They don't need the money. They're very busy. So something is compelling them to go back, go through all that rigmarole and more tests and this and that, stand up and sit down and all the rest of it, you know. And you can speculate as easily as I can, but when I speculate about that, I think only two things would motivate me to do it. One is a kind of slightly competitive, I am going to get through this thing. I'm going to get into the 1% if it kills me. That might be one thing. And the second thing might be thinking, well, actually, I think I am a kind of fairly, you know, unique or special individual. And if my genetic material was passed on to a whole host of other people and it's kind of there in the bank in perpetuity, that might be a good thing, especially if I'm a guy who's so busy that I haven't had time to get around to having my own children in the old-fashioned way.
I just wanted to add something from my research in Mexico. So I did research with McDonald's in Mexico. And there, it was really interesting because they always emphasize that not all of them are admitted to the clinic, and that only the ones who are whiter, so they wouldn't accept like black people or indigenous looking people. So for them, it was really very important to tell everybody they are wanted and say, well, I'm white and I'm pretty.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I think was really crucial that they emphasized their own fertility, so it was an emphasis on their really fertile women and their womanhood. Mm-hmm. So I think it was really. And they all would say, well, we don't tell everybody, but then they told all their roommates and everybody knew.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to say, well, I'm really good looking. And
But these incredibly gendered, racialized stereotypes that, you know, are going into the production of these banks. You know, if we just step back for 1 second, all that, you must be more than 5'9", you must have a degree from Harvard, you must be this, you must be that. I beg you, go and have a look at California Cryo's website. If you just keep going, just keep digging, they will give you some examples, sort of redacted examples of people's profiles. Now, it's interesting, in London, you know, they're so quaintly sort of old-fashioned still, you know, you get the description of many donors and it's like 5'10", brown hair, blue eyes, a biologist who likes to play the trumpet, right? And that's it. That's pretty much everything that you get. When you go to California Cryo, pages and pages of... I just wrote a paper recently, actually, if anyone's interested in Calon's concept of qualification, the qualities, the economy of qualities, the way we qualify products by distinguishing them from other products. And I make an argument that this is a kind of performance of qualification like you've never seen before, because we get to about 7 pages of every single thing this person's ever done, thought, said. You have recordings of them, you have pictures of them as a child, you have their hopes, their dreams, their fears, their personal letters, their family history, self-reported, I might add, so it's basically worthless, going back for 2 or 3 generations, their grandfather's interests, life, etc., etc., etc. So, you know, it's definitely bioinformation that's viewed as very valuable.
One minor point, I was wondering why you were in the beginning quite often using neoliberalism, and now in the discussion you were talking about economization, which seems for me to fit much better, especially if one follows your philanthropic argument and it's, something is brought into markets. Yes, markets are created also, yes, but if I see, oh, I'm doing it for philanthropic reasons, then is it then really neoliberal? That's a minor point. Another point, on the one hand, it seemed to me you're searching for somehow an external position to develop a view on that. You were asking, is it that or isn't it that? Is it exploitation? Can you compare it to other forms of bodily labor historically or not? But isn't the answer itself in the process of producing these subjects? Because this is really very, very, very new. And the role models and the self-understanding and the framing of what you are doing is at the moment under dispute.
Yes.
So I had really problems to think about any external position to say, okay, that is that, or that is that.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, in a way, that's a kind of thinking out loud thing. You know, I'm trying to understand how I'm trying to disrupt that framing while the concrete is still wet. You know, that's what I'm trying to do, really. Because I do see a kind of sedimenting of a particular way of framing, you know, forms of clinical labour, and it's embedded within this, and it's not mine. I wouldn't embed it within a neoliberal argument, but that's where it is being embedded. So of kind of voracious neoliberalism exploiting these poor oppressed clinical workers as a form of, you know, biological capital to be exploited, etc. And in a way, what I was going to say is just hang on a minute before we just get that all fixed. You know, there are surely other ways. And it's important to think about the different kinds of constituencies there are within the broad framework of clinical labour, not to just see them all as a particular kind of subclass. I think that's what troubles me about those accounts.
There was another question over there.
Yeah. You identified the customers of the breeding women in India, but who are the customers of the sperms in California? I mean, like, what is the intention of the people who are actually buying sperm from there?
They're classically, they're couples of all sorts of different descriptions. They might be heterosexual couples or gay couples or whatever, who, for various reasons, one or the other partner either is infertile or, in the case of gay women or single women, they need to source sperm from somewhere. But they have big, as I said, it's a big export market, so there are a lot of people who are buying and shipping that sperm internationally. And you might ask yourself, well, why don't they use something locally that's available locally? And there are complex reasons for that. America is a country that still allows anonymisation of sperm, and in many countries now that is not possible, so the donor has to be identifiable to the offspring of that that sperm. And you might think that that is a positive, that the donor is identifiable, but I think to some families, the idea, although this I find it morally and ethically challenging, but the idea that you don't have to be accountable to any other third party is actually very attractive. So that person is kind of erased from the, you know, equation. So that's one reason why. Ironically, another reason why is because of the HIV crisis that emerged in the United States in the early 80s. All human tissue, including gametes, is now subject to incredibly rigorous testing for all manner of diseases and conditions. So people actually perceive this sperm as biologically as very secure and of very high quality. And then additionally, you've got the fact that you can have these highly qualified descriptions of the donor down to the nth degree. And that would seem to somehow or another guarantee the quality of your offspring. I always find it quite amusing that the missing factor in that is the other half, whoever that might be, who presumably doesn't have a degree from Harvard and might be quite short like me.
I really like the way you traveled, like the stereotypes about how you see surrogates and donors. But then at one point you said, like, the surrogates have the choice, like, to do that and to help women. And I just wondered how you frame this within all the debates and feminism about choice. And I mean, Pandey, in her research on the surrogates in India, she said, well, it's not choice, it's like a choice under economic conditions.
Yeah,
so
look,
I wonder how you deal with
that. I mean, I said, you know, it's a controversial talk in a way, because of course, you know, I know that and I agree with all of that. But the only thing I would say about all that, that just from a strictly personal point of view, is that, you know, we all make choices every day. We have to make choices. Life is short and then it ends, you know. It's like you just only get so much time. So it's not like in an ideal world or in some point in the future, or maybe when this is done and that's done and the other things happen, we'll move into the sunny uplands of life. You know, you just have to make a decision on the basis of what is right in front of you right now. And so to say that these choices are made under economic conditions is absolutely right. That is completely right. And in that sense, people are coerced in unpleasant ways to make decisions that they, you know, that they may find problematic. But what I would say about that is that, unfortunately, that isn't going to change for them anytime soon, not in their lifetime anyway. And so what troubles me is I just think, what right do I have to judge the choices that they make? And some of them make this choice that, you know, 9 months of having a baby, they can manage to do some kind of disassociation technique, which I think a lot of them do quite effectively. We're in an age as well of the internet and heightened connectivity, where it is very unlikely that they will not ever know anything of that child again. as it was historically, when people would take a child and off they'd go and literally you would never see them again. But now children, there's records of who they are and children come looking for them and so on and so on. I mean, my own niece was adopted from Korea and she went back a number of years ago, and even though there was virtually no record of who her biological mother was, she eventually found her and, you know, they had an interesting and quite reconciled sort of meeting, that she didn't wind up wishing that she had stayed there. You know, she was brought up in Australia and her mother went on to marry, had other children, you know, etc. So I think the women feel that they could come to some kind of resolution about the child that they give away. And in the meantime, they earn enough money to put their other surviving children, including young female children, through education and lift them out of poverty and so on. So I just think it's a lot more complex than is comfortable for us to think about quite often.
I think there was Susanna, Marit, and then
probably my question follows a little bit up to the last question. Actually, it seems to me the aim of your talk is to revalue the work of the clinical work women are doing in India.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a little bit, isn't it a little bit hypocrisy? I mean, you make fun of the sperm donors, but you value highly the work of the women in India. I mean, I would do it also, but where's the difference, actually? Mm. Yeah?
Well, I don't think maybe I was a bit flippant, but I don't think I really make fun of them so much as I ask some questions about what they're motivated by. But you'll note that I say that I think they're both doing a kind of philanthropic labour. It's just that, you know, one party who's the kind of sperm donor probably give themselves more of a pat on the back about that than maybe the women do. Part of the reason why, when you started off your question with, now what I think your paper was about, was I thought, oh good, please do tell me what my paper was about. And I mean that sincerely, because it is a kind of thinking out loud, and I often think, you know, I'm standing in the shower thinking, does this mean I'm just justifying, you know, surrogacy or something? Which, by the way, the thing I don't like about any of the sort of surrogacy industry is the way in which it valorizes the biological child, the genetic child, which personally I loathe. So I see no reason why everyone is so obsessed with having their own child. And that's what surrogacy does. But let's put all that in a square bracket, you know, for a moment. And of course, very interestingly in India, and what I was talking about, these things needing to be culturally sensitive, culturally sort of contextually aware, is that of course for me I think, why don't you just go and adopt some other child? There's so many of them out there who are desperate for a home. But of course in India, because of many complex cultural and religious reasons to do with caste and so on, you know, for them that's not really a viable alternative. So, you know, so I don't know. And then I think, well, so should I be all, you know, imperialistic and say we really need to change your attitude to those sorts of things, or do I accept that you know, do I be culturally pluralistic and say, well, that's what you do and I respect that, and so, you know, you must be allowed to have this industry, and if it's your choice to work in it, then rather than, you know, spend 8 hours a day up to your neck in a toxic dye vat, then, you know, that's your choice. But these are the discussions I don't really see happen. I guess that's why I wanted to talk about this in this paper, because I see these very kind of sanitized, politically correct kind of accounts, which are all very comfortable positions for us to occupy. But then when I go there, you know, and I talk to these people and I look at their, I find myself thinking, what? That actually seems like quite a sensible decision to me, actually, to do what you've done. And if I was in your position, I'd probably do it as well. And then I don't feel quite so comfortable about where I'm sitting in relationship to those accounts. So I think it requires more intellectual, you know, work, to be honest with you, than probably we're prepared to or have sort of given it so far.
Yes, thanks very much for this fascinating talk, and I think it was even better that it didn't use all the techniques.
Very good.
Excellent to listen to you. And you did stress all the time that it's so controversial in your talk. But personally, I mean, I found it so convincing that I don't really see the controversy.
Right. That's good.
So I wonder, I mean, I haven't read your paper. It's the first time that I've listened to you, and I'm really fascinated. But I wonder if at first, maybe a geographical difference talking about these issues in Germany, for instance, than in the US or in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So the controversy might be different geographically.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, that's my question. My main question also is, I think your case is really convincing. I can clearly follow you. But it doesn't take away, I think, the argument that a lot of these jobs are precarious and, you know, people are exploiting all that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take it away because
mm-hmm.
it's just a different example of showing, okay, it can be otherwise. But
yeah.
It doesn't mean that the other analysis is not correct, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I think what I would say is that I think the point that I would want to make is that actually it's not different between different people. So these people are doing this in a secure way and these people are doing this in a precarious way, but rather that the whole performance of that labour is really layered for each individual. It operates in a number of registers simultaneously. So it's not a kind of horizontal distinction. It's almost like a vertical one. So what I'm saying is almost for some of those women, it can be simultaneously precarious, it can make them feel vulnerable, but also it can make them, you know, that they can feel that they are doing something really worthwhile, they are performing some kind of philanthropic labour, it's operating in a number of different emotional and economic registers at the same time. And just to sort of classify it as all oppression or all something or another, or else being somehow or another all unproblematic. You know, you sometimes get these stories in the press about other surrogates. Interestingly, that we hear almost nothing about, like whoever it was who had Elton John and David Furnish's baby, who remains unknown to us. But we somehow imagine that for them, actually everything must be just fine, because they got loads of money and they no doubt had the baby in some extremely comfortable Californian clinic and, you know, knowing Elton John, fresh bunches of flowers were delivered every day and so it was all great, you know. And I think that can't possibly be right either, you know. So I think I'm longing for some more complex sort of nuanced accounts of what it is like for each person in that. And I think just writing something off as one thing or another in a rather simplistic way is not actually, doesn't get us all that far.
There was, yeah.
Real quick, I just kind of want to know, how big is this problem in India? I mean, we did get a sense of, you know, I do think that it's a problem, but how big is it? And compared to something like the sweatshop industry in India, which we all know is also a big problem, is this not more of a developing country issue in general? And if so, how do we go about taking actions towards fixing it? Because in this series in particular, we've heard of a lot of analysis of problems, but not really how we go about fixing these problems or addressing them in real life. So what would you say to that?
Okay, well, a few points there. The first thing is, I haven't done any direct comparisons with other industries, so I can't give you any definitive figures on that. But there is no question that the assisted reproduction industry is booming in developing countries, and it very interestingly, you might imagine that it's still on a rising trajectory in India, and it is in some respects, but very interestingly they have introduced some more restrictions on surrogacy now in India, some more regulation. But what I was fascinated to discover was that, guess what that did? It just pushed it all somewhere else. And where did it push it to? To Thailand. That's where you go now, so everybody tells me. If you want to have a baby by a surrogate and you're like anyone, so two gay women, two gay men, single man, single woman, anyone, you go to Thailand. That's where the doors are open for business. So, in fact, India is not the most liberal of the developing emerging economies in terms of the provision of ART. I would say probably Southeast Asia, and you may have other, Mexico as well, is another hotspot. And in answer to your question, you know, what do you do about it? Well, I think part of my talk, in a way, was about asking us to think about, so what is the problem? And for whom is it a problem? And does that, you know, how do we characterise it as a problem? What does that mean about what we do about it? So for some people it isn't a problem, or they wouldn't see it as a problem. Even I could suggest that for some women who are involved in surrogacy, they wouldn't see it as a problem either. They would think, well, you know, I can make more money doing this and I can set myself up for the rest of my life. So that's a bit of an affront when you realise that, you know, maybe they wouldn't see it as a problem either. And it's interesting, you know, when I was younger in Australia, I fought for land rights for Aboriginal people, you know, like many, many people did for many years. And then when they got their land rights, the first thing they did was allowed uranium mining on their lands because they earned an awful lot of money out of it. And we were like, huh? Hang on a minute. That wasn't what we meant. But of course, you know, that's their right. So sometimes you don't get the answer that you think you're going to get when you think of how you understand something as a problem and what we do about it. I guess the question in that is who's the we in that question. But certainly I think trying that question of whether there can be a normative global ethics for these issues is, I think, actually one of the most taxing questions that sits before us, and that's what this project that I'm doing in India is also on. It has another element, which is, you know, can you do a global ethical framework for these kinds of events, or are they always so context dependent that you can't really do that?
I have one question. There seems to be an increasing rate of infertility around the world. And my interest is, what is the percentage of people being a normal couple, meaning male and female, who are searching for fertility solutions in that, let's say, industry?
1 in 7, I'm told now. 1 in 7.
Are, let's say, normal couple.
Yeah, are, okay, quote-unquote, infertile. But what infertile often means in that context is that they've just waited for so long that their fertility
is... Now you reduce it to being the males being infertile.
Okay. Sorry, say that again.
Now you told me that it's the males that are infertile.
No. I'm saying in couples. You know, 1 in 7 couples, so they say, now are seeking fertility help with their fertility.
From a long, let's say, couple.
Yeah. And that could be, what I'm saying is that could be, sometimes that is a result, not of kind of a
My
structural...
My question was demanding for fertility solutions in sperm banks or in India, the customers that reach that addresses, what is the portion of being couples being infertile?
Yeah.
Not homosexual couples, not...
Yeah, 1 in 7. Persons. 1 in 7.
And 1 in 7. Okay, thanks.
Are there any other questions? Answering the other question, you said that you have to make a choice now, but if you see from a structuralist perspective, I've never been to India, is it really that you have to make a choice, or would it be, if you had the choice to make it better in the long run,
would that be a choice you would make if you could make that choice?
Ah, I might need a drink before I can answer that question. But I think you mean, is it if you make a decision to go in for something like surrogacy now, is that what you're saying? Then is it easier to make that if you don't have to consider what the longer term impacts are?
No, you just that you now have the choice to do it or to do another kind of work as
yeah.
a woman.
Yep.
But you cannot consider the long run because you don't have the time, or you don't have the time to establish a different system, or think about a different system even, because you now have to make the choice now.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you personally could make the choice to establish a system in a bigger time horizon. If you would make the choice, so you would say, okay, the better choice now would be to not work for 15 years, but to do the 9-month pregnancy. But if you had the third option of changing something in the long run for the women, would you choose that option?
Mm. Well, I mean, you know, the long term, I think, you know, when I was saying to you, some women use the money to educate their female children, you know, and lift them out of poverty. If that's a definite advantage to them, and there has an intergenerational advantage for their children, but then that poses the rather uncomfortable question: well, do you allow a practice that you think is unacceptable to be perpetuated now because you think it's going to have those, you know, beneficial effects for those women and their children for the next 20 or 30 years. But then in 20 or 30 years, those children might be making the same decision because nothing's changed between now and then. So, you know, perhaps you have to reach a point where you go, no, we're just not going to do any more of that. And if you suffer, then you suffer. And that's, you know, for the benefit of making sure that this isn't perpetuated over a long, you know, time scale. But might be, you know, an ideal way to do that. But of course, the nature of markets is such that the market is not going to go away. And in fact, in relationship to your question of how many people seek these services now, because people are delaying having children for longer because of their professional and working lives and the choices that they make, the demand for these services is actually dramatically increasing. And so it seems very unlikely that anyone is suddenly going to say, well, let's have a moratorium on surrogacy because, you know, we've outlawed it. I mean,
so
they're not going to do that voluntarily.
So you'd say the goods outweigh the negative aspects at the moment?
Well, I don't think I could do something quite so cut and dried as that, but I think I just think the question of how you address the issue is very complex and requires some, you know, careful thinking through, basically.
Do you actually have any information about whether the circumstances of this clinical labour are contested in some way? Because earlier you mentioned sex workers organising their interests to, you know, fight for better labour conditions, so I was wondering if actually anything like that is...
I mean, in India there are organisations like SAMA, which is the SAMA, which is a, you know, a prominent feminist organisation that works for the rights of women who are involved in all of these kind of elements of the bioeconomy and try and represent women, improve their status and their conditions of work. And, you know, organisations, NGOs like that have been responsible for a lot of improvements in their conditions of work and how they work and how they're treated in clinics and so forth.
Are there any more questions? If it's not the case, I would take seriously your hint that you need a drink to answer some more questions. And I would really warmly invite everybody to the post-colloquium, also the students, not only the staff, which will take place at the Taboo Bar, which is here in West End, and we can go there together if you like to join us. And I would like to thank you again for this very inspiring talk.
Thank you all very much for coming.